"Never thought," said Lizzie stiffly. "I'd live to hear my girl say such a thing!"
Ashamed, Feathers strode more slowly. She turned Lizzie's words over and over in her mind.
"Marriage!" she exclaimed.
"The prince, who rescues the princess from the dragon's lair, is always forced to marry her, whether they've taken a liking to one another or not. That's the custom, and I don't doubt that custom will apply to the trapeze artiste who rescues the clown. The name of this custom is a happy ending."
"Marriage!" repeated Feathers,
in a murmur of awed distaste. But after a moment, she perked up.
"Oh, but Liz, think of his malleable look, as if a girl could mould him any way she wanted. Surely he'll have the decency to give himself to me, when we meet again, not expect the vice versa. Let him hand himself over into my safekeeping, and I will transform him. You said yourself he was unhatched, Lizzie. Very well, I'll sit on him. I'll hatch him out. I'll make a new man of him. I'll make him into the new man, in fact, fitting mate for the new woman, and onward we'll march hand in hand into the new century."
Lizzie detected a note of rising hysteria in the girl's voice.
"Perhaps so, perhaps not," she said, putting a damper on things. "Perhaps safer not to plan ahead."
Feathers thought her foster mother's conversation was as dour as the empty landscape around them. She whistled to keep her spirits up, the ride of the Valkyries. Something pathetic about her little whistle piping away in the middle of Siberia, but she persevered. After a short pause, Lizzie took another tack.
"However, I will say this for you. Unless you propose to sell your story to the newspaper, my dear, and steal a march on Colonel Kearney..."
Feathers, hoping to change the subject, stopped whistling to interject.
"Oom, Liz, we could pillory in the press for his business practice and his treatment of employees,
unless you plan to sell yourself in print. I can't see any profit in all this, try as I might. And perhaps it is a sign of moral growth in you, my girl."
Feathers began whistling again, but Lizzie pressed on.
"That you pursue this fellow only for his body, not for what he'll pay you. Inconvenient as your acute attack of morality might prove in the long term, should it become chronic, as far as the financing of the struggle is concerned."
"Have you finished? Have you quite finished? Why don't you come with me if all you can do is carp?"
"You don't know the first thing about the human heart,"
said Liz, dolefully.
"The heart is a treacherous organ, and you're nothing if not impetuous. I fear for you, Sophie. Selling yourself is one thing, and giving yourself away is quite another. But, oh, Sophie, what if you rashly throw yourself away? Then what happens to that unique meanness of yours? On the scrap heap, that's what happens to it. I'll raise you to fly to the heavens, not to brood over a clutch of eggs."
"Eggs? What have eggs got to do with it?"
And they would have immediately started to quarrel again, if, just at that moment, they had not seen, first sign of humanity for miles, a frail little shelter built of branches propped against a pine of grandfatherly dimensions. At first, you might not have noticed the shelter, for there were no doors, no windows, nor apertures of any kind in it, so that it looked more like a woodpile than a primitive hut. But in the wilderness, a woodpile was as out of place as an ocean-going yacht, and besides, as they drew nearer, they heard from within some muffled groans and sobs. Liz motioned to Feathers to remain behind, for the little woman was lighter on her feet by far than the heavy-treading aerialiste, and crept up to the shelter softly enough to surprise whatever lurked within. But the woman, who lay there on a pile of filthy straw, was in no condition to be surprised. Removing a log, Lizzie peered in at her. It was the grey light of the end of the short day outside, and there was no light or fire inside, so Lizzie made haste to find matches she'd stolen from the maestro. By the little light, she saw the prone woman, in spite of the bitter chill of the approaching night, wore nothing but an old fringed buckskin dress, which had been slit up the middle to expose her still bulging belly. Perhaps she'd thrown off the bedclothes, for she seemed feverish, even delirious. At any rate, no bedclothes covered her, although there were a few cured skins lying here and there. A crude wooden container beside her proved itself to be a cradle, when the baby inside it woke up and began to cry. Lizzie carefully removed a couple more logs and stepped through the hole. She found a stub of candle in her bag and lit that. At first she thought the baby with its rosy cheeks looked very healthy. Then, when she picked it up to soothe it, she saw that what disguised its waxen look was blood, smeared on like rouge, an old practice of the tribe. The mother opened her eyes. If she thought a bear had invaded the privacy of her postpartural ritual, she took it in her stride. Another bear dismantled yet more of the wall of her shelter and lumbered in. The mother's expression did not change. Lizzie felt her forehead with the back of her hand. It was very hot.
"Tuck her up," said Liz to Feathers, taking charge of the baby.
"What the hell is going on?"
demanded Feathers, as she did as she was bid.
"I'm sure I don't know,"
said Lizzie,
"unless this tableau of a woman in bondage to her reproductive system, a woman tied hand and foot to that nature which your physiology denies, Sophie, has been set here on purpose to make you think twice about turning from a freak into a woman."
Lizzie held the baby to the young mother's breast, but either the young mother's milk had not yet come, or she had none, for the baby grasped the nipple in its mouth and sucked furiously, then with a sharp cry of disappointment, let go, and face crumpling, began to bellow and shake its fists. At that, the mother wept as much as her exhaustion and fever permitted her. Feathers rubbed the cold hands in her warm ones, while Lizzie tucked the baby snugly inside her fur.
"I'm not leaving this little babe out here, and that's flat," she announced. "Poor little scrapple catch is deaf as well as staff."
"You always was partial to a foundling," said Feathers, with an acid edge, but also with renewed affection. "What about his poor old mum, though? Ain't she a foundling, too?"
"You can manage her, ducks."
"She's not much of a weight," acknowledged Feathers, heaving.
The woman came to herself briefly and smiled. If she had realized Feathers was not a bear but a woman, she would have complained bitterly, because the taboo surrounding childbirth had been broken. As it was, she let herself be carried off with a good grace to, as she thought, the land of the dead. She was pleased to hear the babble of little cries as her baby set off in the same direction. They kicked aside the walls of the shelter, the easiest way of returning to the open air. As Feathers stepped over the scattered branches, with a well-wrapped young mother in her arms, she glimpsed something in the disturbed snow that made her cry out.
"Oh, Liz!"
A miracle of frail violets, frost-nipped and pale, the colour of tired eyelids, yet big with perfume and optimism, were in full bloom among the sheltered roots of the big pine. Violets!
"Violets!"
said Lizzie.
"On New Year's Eve!"
"Look at 'em, the little darlings!"
bubbled Feathers.
"Like a message from little Violetta to say we're not forgotten. Here, did you say it's New Year's Eve?"
Liz nodded.
"I've been keeping count. By my count, it's New Year's Eve. We're on the cusp, my dear. Tomorrow is another time scheme."
Feathers hoisted the young mother over her shoulder and stooped, but Liz adjured.
"Don't pick 'em. Leave 'em to seed theirselves. Snow violets. Must be rare as rare."
Beneath her apparent indifference, she too was moved, and the two women smiled at one another, knowing a truce, or even peace, had been declared again.
"I spy,"
and Lizzie pointed. There was a footprint in the snow beside the violets. They had not been the first to stop and admire them. Print of a soft-soled boot. One footprint only, like Man Friday's, just as mysterious, just as ominous.
"Over there!"
Feathers turned to point. A rag of red ribbon was caught on the twig of a tree. The magic midwife took care to hide the track she'd made when she came to tend her hidden patient, but not sufficient care. Had not the bears come and kidnapped mother and child? A few yards beyond the red ribbon, they came across a little tin bell, lying at the side of a dissolving track of beaten snow. Now they were on the high road to somewhere, and strode along in better spirits than they'd known for days. Soon they saw before them lights, faintly gleaming through thick windows paned with horn, and the roof of long, low wooden houses, and smoke rising from chimneys, and a rich, strange smell of unfamiliar suppers cooking on unfamiliar hearths, and it was evening. Feather's heart, already stirred by the surprise of the violets, warmed still further at these homely sights and odours. Her village, homes, the signs of the human hand keeping the wilderness at bay. Life seemed to her to have been held in suspension during their wanderings in the solitude. Now the solitude existed no longer, and things were about to pick up again. She might even find bleach or dye in this village, might she not, and start to put herself back together again. And surely he was here. One of the wooden houses must shelter the young American, and she would see once again the wonder in the eyes of the beloved and become whole. Already she felt more blonde.
"Think of him, not as a lover, but as a scribe, as an amanuensis," she said to Lizzie. "And not of my trajectory alone, but of yours too, Lizzie. Of your long history of exile and cunning, which you scarcely hinted to him, which will fill up 10 times more of his notebooks than my story ever did. Think of him as the amanuensis of all those whose tales we've yet to tell, the histories of those women who would otherwise go down nameless and forgotten, erased from history, as if they had never been, so that he too will put his poor shoulder to the wheel and help to give the world a little turn into the new era that begins tomorrow. And once the old world has turned on its axle so that the new dawn can dawn, then, oh, then, all the women will have wings the same as I. This young woman in my arms, who we found tied hand and foot with the grisly bonds of ritual, will suffer no more of it. She will tear off her mind-fogged manacles, will rise up and fly away. The dolls' houses' doors will open, the brothels will spill forth their prisoners, the cages, gilded or otherwise, all over the world in every land will let forth their inmates, singing together the dawn chorus of the new, the transformed.
It's going to be more complicated than that, interpolated Lizzie. This old witchy storm's head, my girl. When I look to the future, I see through a glass darkly. You improve your analysis skill, and then we'll discuss it.
But her daughter swept on, regardless, as if intoxicated with vision.
On that bright day, when I am no more a singular being but warts and all, the female paradigm, no longer an imagined fiction but a plain fact, then he will slap down his notebooks, bear witness to me and my prophetic role. Think of him, Lizzie, as one who carries the evidence.
Cushy, cushy, coo,
said Lizzie to the restless baby. There were no streets or squares or alleys in this village. The houses were set sometimes close to, sometimes far apart, as if the arrangement had been copied from the random way cows lie down in fields. No sign of any inhabitants, all indoors at this hour, but a reindeer or two raised its antlered head to peer at the newcomers, then settled back to scratching for moss. Bells and ribbons were attached to a larch tree, outside the longest, lowest, somehow most official-looking building in the village, giving it a festive air. Lizzie knocked on the door, noting how the frame was decorated with more red ribbons, feathers and, bones. When she knocked, came a muffled growl from inside, a flurry and a thump, and a man's voice raised in an unfamiliar tongue.
"Does that mean come in?"
Feather shrugged.
"Open up, I'm perishing."
They pushed the creaking door. No sign of life inside as far as could be seen, which wasn't much, for the draughty interior was lit only fitfully by a primitive lamp consisting of a tinware saucer filled with melted bear grease, in which the wick floated in imminent danger of shipwreck. This lamp hung by cords from the crossbeam and moved in the draughts so that the shadows came and went with eerie unpredictability, offering unprepossessing glimpses of strange-shaped, oddly coloured objects against the walls and in the corners, hinting at lumpish silent occupants, crouched hither and thither, but covering up everything with darkness again almost immediately. Below the lamp, stood a long table, marked with one or two odd-looking stains, on which lay a big wooden platter, hollowed out not with a chisel, but by the application of fire, and a stone knife, of antique shape, but very finely honed as to the blade. Spattered on the beaten earth floor around the table were traces of old blood, of fur and of feathers, trodden into the ground by, presumably, the feet of priests and worshippers. The smell was hideous, as of incense mingled with death, and it was very cold.
"What did I tell you?" said Lizzie. "One of their churches. Typical church atmosphere."
Something. The wind in the rafters, a rat, a concealed priest, rustled when she spoke. And the place was so ill-lit, the entire population of the village might have been concealed in the thick, haunted dark. There was a nightmarish sense of claustrophobia about the place, that was yet tense with expectancy, as if something hideous had been prevented from happening by their arrival. But the actors in the interrupted rite were patient and could wait, were waiting, and seeing what these beings who'd brought the mother and child back to the village were up to. Custom-built for wholly arcane, archaic practices, for revelations, for consultations with the dead, for sacrifices, the wild church was intended to impress, and was impressive. But Lizzie and Feathers owed their capacity for survival to a refusal to be impressed by their surroundings. Feathers gently laid the young mother down on the table with a relieved grunt and stretched her weary arms. The young mother opened her eyes and took note of her surroundings. The god hut of her native village. And why had the baby stopped crying? She found she felt a little less unwell and started to gather her strength in order to get up and investigate the preparations for her own funeral she was sure were underway.
"Look out!" hissed Lizzie.
There was a man in the corner. No, not a man. The women breathed again. There in the corner, now lit, now dark again according to the swaying of the lamp, stood a wooden image, somewhat larger than the little life-size of the woodsman, wrapped in furs, shawls and girdles. And there was one white shirt on him, the front of which was stiff with dried egg liquor. Feather's heart went pitter-pat when she saw that. The idol's head bore several three-pointed caps made of black, blue and red cloth, but it was hard to see much of its face because of the furs, shawls and bits of lace and tin and ribbon that covered it. Its maw appeared to be ravening, however, and its eyes, made of discs of beaten tin, flashed when visited by the wavering flame of the lamp. The idol spoke.
"Whence cometh thou? Whither goeth thou?"
The startled baby bawled to hear the idol speak in good American. The young mother leapt from the table. That yell was never posthumous, and grappled with Lizzie for possession of the baby, adding her own shrieks to the din. Lizzie delivered up the baby so she could catch hold of a growling something as it came out from under the table, where the shaman had kicked it when the sacrifice was interrupted before it began. The bear, affronted, cuffed Lizzie about the head, and they scuffled together, knocking over the table as they did so. The dish and knife fell clattering to the floor. They banged against the idol in their wrestling. The idol toppled against another one, similarly clad, with more of a stag-like look. Toppling in its turn, the staggy deity knocked the next in line of the row of idols from its perch, and so on, in a domino effect of comprehensive desecration. A number of skulls rolled round the floor, released from their stash under the ursine idol. It was not at first apparent these were the skulls of bears. The disturbed lamp swished back and forth faster and faster, splashing hot grease over everything. Feathers kept her head sufficiently to dance backwards from the melee, singing out, come out, wherever you are!" The lamp dipped and swung with such energy, the lit wick flew off, hit the wall and was extinguished, leaving the god hut black as pitch, in which unseen presences made themselves felt with a vengeance, pinching, punching, sometimes made of fur, sometimes of leather, emitting weird screeches and jingle-jangling away their little bells. Had the women been attacked by the ghosts of a team of Morris dancers? Feathers wrestled with an invisible until she smelt flesh and bit hard. She bit bone and tasted blood. It was alive. There was an ugly but unmistakably human squawk. She made a grab. Another squawk. As she ascertained, she wrestled with a male. Once Lizzie got an armlock on the bear, she located the dropped stone knife with her foot and kept her foot firmly down on it, in spite of the blows with which some leathery, gibbering, tinkling thing belabored her. Feathers did not let go of the hand between her teeth as she tumbled the rest of the faceless anatomy to the ground, where she plumped herself down on his chest, breathing heavily. It shouted in a language that sounded not as if spoken, but as if knitted on steel needles. It must have asked for some light on the business, for a moment later came an odd, cadaverous glow from somewhere in a corner, accompanied by a peculiar smell. The fuss died down, as if the light calmed them. A last whimper from the baby, a snuffle from the bear, and in the ensuing hush, Feathers saw whom she straddled. Walser wore his ceremonial dress and a triangular cap with a fur trim and a piece of tin cut in the shape of a dollar sign at the front. He was a little thinner in the face. To a European eye, the pale gold beard, which now reached halfway down his chest, ill-matched his leather petticoats, and he could have done with soap and water. He stank. And that was not the half of it, for there was a vatic glare in his grey eyes eyes of a glossy brilliance, his eyes with the pinpoint pupils, a vatic glare, and no trace of scepticism at all. Furthermore, they seemed to have lost their power to reflect. Feathers felt the hairs on her nape rise when she saw that he was looking at her, as if horror of horrors. She was perfectly natural. Natural, but abominable. He fixed her with his phosphorescent eye, and after a moment, his voice rose in song.
Only a bird in a gilded cage. Oh, my God, said Feathers,
for he had translated the familiar tune into some kind of chant, some kind of dirge, some kind of Siberian invocation of the spectral inhabitants of the other world which coexists with this one. And Feathers knew in her bones his song was meant to do her harm. The shaman identified her fur, her hair, her broken wing, and was a little consoled to see how quickly she was fading. He eyed the young mother and her baby assessingly. Did the bear spirits intend them as a substitute for the cub? It would seem so. The smaller one still stood firmly on the sacrificial knife, however. Perhaps they intended to do the job themselves. The thing to do, obviously, was to assist the bear spirits to fade away as quickly as possible, before they stretched mother and baby out on the altar again. He snatched up his drum, which was propped against the wall, and banged away at an exorcism with the energy of the desperate. Walser's voice swooped and quavered with a sound to Feathers like the very essence of madness. Feathers felt that shivering sensation which always visited her when mages, wizards, impresarios came to take away her singularity, as though it were their own invention, as though they believed she depended on their imaginations in order to be herself. She felt herself turning willy-nilly from a woman into an idea. The shaman redoubled the vigour of his drumming and began to sing a song with strange yippings and yowlings in it. From an unseen censer, a purple disorienting incense filled the god hut, so the shaman seemed to multiply himself until there were dozens of him banging dozens of drums in the same appeal to this thing that was and was not Feathers. In Walser's eyes, she saw herself at last swimming into definition, like the image on photographic paper, but instead of Feathers, she saw two perfect miniatures of a dream. She felt her outlines waver. She felt herself trapped forever in the reflection in Walser's eyes. For one moment, just one moment, Feathers suffered the worst crisis of her life. Am I fact? Or am I fiction? Am I what I know I am? Or am I what he thinks I am?
Show him your feathers, quick, urged Lizzie.
Feathers, with a strange sense of desperation, a miserable awareness of her broken wing and her discoloured plumage, could think of nothing else to do but to obey. She shrugged off her furs, and though she could not spread two wings, she spread one. Lopsided angel, partial and shabby splendour. No Venus or Helen or angel of the apocalypse, no Israel or Isfahel, only a poor freak, down on her luck, and an object of the most dubious kind of reality to her beholders, since both the men in the God Hut were accustomed to hallucinations, and she who looks like a hallucination but is not, had no place in their view of things. The door creaked, and creaked again, and Feathers knew without turning round that some of Walser's new friends had arrived to see what the fuss was about. All manner of yellow faces now showed up at the door, looking like risen moons in the light of the lamps they carried. She felt their eyes on her back, and tentatively fluttered the one whole wing at them. She was hesitant, uncertain at first. But then her plumage, yes it did, her plumage rippled in the wind of wonder, their expelled breaths. Ooh! As ever, that wind refreshed her spirits. It blew and blew through the God Hut, blowing away the drugged perfumes and smells of old blood. She cocked her head to relish the shine of the lamps, like footlights, like stage lights. It was as good as a stiff brandy to see those footlights and beyond them the eyes fixed upon her with astonishment, with awe, the eyes that told her who she was. She would be the blonde of blondes again, just as soon as she found peroxide. It was as easy as that. And meanwhile, who cared? And of course her wing would mend. It would mend when the snow melted to reveal the whole tiger covered with violets. And that was when she would soar up on her mended wing above the village, above the forest, above the mountains and the frozen seas, her loved ones in her arms. Home! Yes! She would see Trafalgar Square again and Nelson on his plinth and Chelsea Bridge as it dissolved into the Thames at twilight, and St. Paul's, the single Amazon breast of her beloved native city. Hubris, imagination, desire. The blood sang in her veins. Their eyes restored her soul. She rose up from her kneeling position on Walser's chest. She put on a brilliant artificial smile, extending her arms as if to enfold all present in a vast embrace. She sank down in a curtsy towards the door, offering herself to the company as if she were a gigantic sheaf of gladioli. Then she sank down in a curtsy towards Walser, now scrambling to his feet, with an expression on his face as of the clearing of a haze. And then she saw. He was not the man he had been, or would ever be again. Some other hen had hatched him out. For a moment, she was anxious as to who this reconstructed Walser might turn out to be. "What is your name? Have you a soul? Can you love?" he demanded of her in a great rhapsodic rush as she rose up out of her curtsy. When she heard that, her heart lifted and sang. She batted her lashes at him, beaming, exuberant, newly armed. Now she looked big enough to crack the roof of the God Hut, all wild hair and feathers and triumphant breasts and blue eyes the size of dinner plates. "That's the way to start the interview," she cried. "Get out your pencil and we'll begin." Envoy. "For you must know that Liz just lost a child when she found me. So she took me to her breast and suckled me. And it was, of course, never religion that made her such an inconvenient harlot, but her habit of lecturing the clients on the white slave trade, the rights and wrongs of women, universal suffrage, as well as the Irish question, the Indian question, republicanism, anti-clericism, syndicalism, and the abolition of the House of Lords. With all of which Nelson was in full sympathy, but as she said, the world won't change overnight and we must eat. Those letters we sent home by you in the diplomatic bag were news of the struggle in Russia to comrades in exile, written in invisible ink. So we made most grievous use of you, I'm sorry to say. For if the secret police had found out about it, you'd have been sent to Siberia, somewhere we couldn't find you. But Liz would do it,
having made a promise to a spry little gent with a tash she met in the reading room of the British Museum. Furthermore, we played a trick on you with the aid of Nelson's clock the first night we met, in the Alhambra, London. But the clock is gone, and I'll play tricks on you. No more. We told you no other lies, nor in any way strayed from the honest truth. Believe it or not, all that I told you as real happenings were so, in fact. And as to questions of whether I am fact or fiction, you must answer that for yourself.
Without her clothes on, she looked the size of a house. She was engaged in washing herself piece by piece in a pot of water drawn from the samovar, while Walser, naked but for his beard, waited on the shaman's brass bed. He saw without surprise. She indeed appeared to possess no navel. But he was no longer in the mood to draw any definite conclusions from this fact. Her released feathers brushed against the walls. He recalled how nature had equipped her only for the woman on top position and rustled on his straw mattress. He was as much himself again as ever he would be, and yet that self would never be the same again, for now he knew the meaning of fear as it defines itself in its most violent form, that is, fear of the death of the beloved, of the loss of the beloved, of the loss of love. It was the beginning of an anxiety that would never end except with the deaths of either or both. An anxiety is the beginning of conscience, which is the parent of the soul, but is not compatible with innocence. Lizzie might sniff.
Look at him, Sophie. All for mumbo-jumbo and ladies' dresses now.
But apart from this shaft, had looked on him almost kindly, for in the light of his grey eyes, her foster daughter was transformed back into her old self again, without an application of peroxide even. After a deal of nodding and winking from feathers, Lizzie had adjourned with the shaman, his cousin, her eldest daughter, and the new baby, to the cousin's house, in which improvised maternity ward she embarked on the elaboration of an extensive ritual of mother and baby care, which religiously implemented over the next decade more than made up for the low birth rate by the reduction in perinatal mortality it procured. The shaman's cousin, the magic midwife, kept an amulet bag next to the samovar, just as he did. Lizzie cocked an interested eye. Might she, perhaps, find herself a new handbag amongst these friendly and intelligent, if somewhat backward and superstitious folk? The shaman, entranced by her moustache, addressed her reverently as Little Mother of All the Bears. The bear cub tagged along behind her like the victim of a teenage crush. Lizzie sternly repressed the temptation to take, just this once, just for the night, a little holiday from rationality, and play at being a minor deity.
Is there some place we can be alone?
Feathers had suggested, batting her eyelashes in an unequivocal fashion. Walser, whose head was clearing minute by minute, seized her hand and ran her to the shaman's house, but lost the initiative immediately as she pinned him cheerfully to the bed and told him to wait while she freshened up. She seemed to be washing the colour back into her cheeks. She sang as she washed. What else but the habanera from Carmen?
Am I biting off more than I can chew?
Pondered Walser. He contemplated, as in a mirror, the self he was so busily reconstructing.
I am Jack Walser, an American citizen. I joined the circus of Colonel Kearney in order to delight my reading public with accounts of a few nights at the circus, and, as a clown, perform before the Tsar of all the Russians. To great applause. What a story! I was derailed by brigands in Transbaikalia, and lived as a wizard among the natives for a while. God, what a story! Let me introduce my wife, Mrs. Sophie Walser, who formerly had a successful career on the music hall stage under the name of...
Oh!
Unbeknownst to the lovers, midnight, that movable feast, rolled over the tiger at that moment, disturbing nothing in its passage, in spite of the era it was dragging in its wake. precipitated in ignorance and bliss into the next century, there, after it was over, Walser took himself apart and put himself together again. Jack, ever an adventurous boy, ran away with the circus for the sake of a bottle blonde in whose hands he was putty since the first moment he saw her. He got himself into scrape upon scrape, danced with a tigress, posed as a roast chicken, finally got himself an apprenticeship in the higher form of the confidence trick, initiated by a wily old pederast who bamboozled him completely. All that seemed to happen to me in the third person as though most of my life I watched it but did not live it, and now, hatched out of the shell of unknowing by a combination of a blow on the head and a sharp spasm of erotic ecstasy, I shall have to start all over again. Smothered in feathers and pleasure, as he was, there was still one question teased him.
Feathers,
he said. Some sixth sense kept him from calling her Sophie. They were not yet sufficiently intimate.
Feathers, only the one question. Why did you go to such lengths once upon a time to convince me you were the only fully feathered intacta in the history of the world?
She began to laugh.
I fooled you then, she said. God, I fooled you.
She laughed so much the bed shook.
You mustn't believe what you write in the papers, she assured him,
stuttering and hiccuping with mirth.
To think I fooled you.
Her laughter spilled out of the window and made the tin ornaments on the tree outside the god hut shake and tinkle. She laughed so loud that the baby in the shaman's cousin's house heard her, waved its little fists in the air, and laughed delightedly too. Although he did not understand the joke that convulsed the baby, the shaman caught the infection and started to giggle. The bear panted sympathetically. He would have laughed if he could have. The shaman's cousin caught Lizzie's eye, and they both doubled up. Even the young mother in her peaceful bed of reindeer skin smiled in her sleep. Feathers' laughter seeped through the gaps in the window frames and cracks in the door frames of all the houses in the village. The villagers stirred in their beds, chuckling at the enormous joke that invaded their dreams, of which they would remember nothing in the morning except the mirth it caused. She laughed, she laughed, she laughed. It seemed this laughter of the happy young woman rose up from the wilderness in a spiral and began to twist and shudder across Siberia. It tickled the sleeping sides of the inhabitants of the railhead at R. It penetrated the counterpoint of the music in the maestro's house. The members of the Republic of Free Women experienced it as a refreshing breeze. The colonel and the SKP, snug in a smoking compartment on the way to Khabarovsk, caught the echoes and found abashed smiles creeping across their faces. The spiraling tornado of Feathers' laughter began to twist and shudder across the entire globe, as if a spontaneous response to the giant comedy that endlessly unfolded beneath it, until everything that lived and breathed everywhere was laughing. Or so it seemed to the deceived husband, who found himself laughing too, even if he was not quite sure whether or not he might be the butt of the joke. Feathers, sputtering to a stop at last, crouched above him, covering his face with kisses. Oh, how pleased with him she was.
To think I really fooled you, she marvelled. It just goes to show, there's nothing like confidence.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Nights at the Circus, written by Angela Carter and read by Adjoa Ando. Copyright 1984 by Angela Carter. Production copyright 2018 by Audible Limited. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Limited.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.